Верховная Рада ухвалила пакет законов.
В соответствии с этими законами теперь Великую Отечественную войну
все архивы НКВС и КДБ.
Открытие архивов всех репрессивных органов колишнего СРСР в Украине.
Деятельности Компартии Украины.
Заборонили пропагувати коммунистический и нацистский режим. Как вы до этого ставитесь?
Что происходит? Украина таким образом пытается справиться со своими оппонентами.
Дякую за поддержку. Вітаю всех нас с принятием этого важного исторического решения.
When Ukrainians began toppling Lenin statues at the height of the Euromaidan revolution, it seemed almost retro, as if we had gone back in time to 1991. And in some ways, we had. Because to many of its supporters, last year's Ukrainian uprising represented reviving the dashed hopes and promise of that heady time. Hopes for a truly independent Ukraine that had broken from its Soviet past and was free from Russian domination in its present. But as Ukraine's pro-Western rulers are now learning, putting these hopes into practice is a lot trickier than knocking down a monument. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me in the studio is Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFURL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. Welcome back, Natalia.
Thank you. Hi.
And joining us on the Skype line from Kyiv is Taras Kuzio, a senior research associate at the Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. Welcome back, Taras.
Hi.
And also joining us from Kyiv, also via Skype, is Lucan Wei of the Center for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Toronto. Welcome to the podcast, Lucan.
Hi.
Earlier this month, Ukraine's parliament passed a broad package of bills aimed at decommunization. The legislation opened the archives of Soviet-era security services in Ukraine. It equally condemned Soviet and Nazi regimes in Ukraine. It banned communist and Nazi symbols, honored, quote, those who struggled for Ukraine's independence in the 20th century, end quote, and mandated the elimination of communist-inspired names for streets, squares, and other places. The laws were predictably condemned by Moscow. But they were also assailed by a large group of Ukrainian and Western scholars who signed an open letter to President Petro Poroshenko urging him to veto the legislation. The signatories argued that the proposed laws threatened the right to free speech and glorified Ukrainian nationalist groups that committed atrocities and collaborated with the Nazis during World War II. They also argued that the legislation would divide Ukraine and give fodder to its enemies. I'll quote from the letter here now. If signed, the laws of April 9th will be a gift to those who wish to turn Ukraine against itself. They will alienate many Ukrainians who now find themselves under de facto occupation. They will divide and dishearten Ukraine's friends. In short, they will damage Ukraine's national unity. And for this reason, above all, we urge you to reject them, they wrote to Poroshenko. Lucan, you were among the signatories of this letter. Can you elaborate for our listeners on your reasoning?
Yes, thank you. Right now, Ukraine is being invaded by Russia. This is not the time to divide Ukraine. It's the time to unite Ukraine. Now, what these laws do is they basically legislate interpretation of history. This is what the Soviet Union did. We had 70 years of this. I think we had enough of this. The truth is that there are real differences of opinion on these issues in Ukraine. And what this law does is it politicizes those differences. And that, in that sense, it is a real gift to Putin. You know, rather than talking about Putin's crimes, we're talking about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, Natalia, you and I have had some conversations off mic, and I know you have a different opinion, and which illustrates what Lucan's talking about here to a degree. But what are your thoughts on this?
I really agree with Lucan that the timing of these laws is really very important, and we do have to bear in mind that Ukraine is in the state of war with Russia, and the way I see these laws is not the way to divide Ukraine and to discuss again the affiliations of Ukrainians and their attitude towards the Soviet past. As it is, to me, it is more as a declaration of independence. In the sense that it is the first time that Ukrainians are looking at their history through their own eyes. They don't look at it through the eyes of the Soviet Union or the Russians or the Poles or anybody else. They declare this is our view of history and this is what we are going to support. And I don't think this really causes that much interpretation inside of Ukraine, except for some of the scholars who are afraid that their freedom of speech, freedom of research might be somehow curtailed by this law. But I think these laws, and especially the laws opening the archives, are doing exactly the opposite. They open a huge area of undiscovered, unstudied documents, which can be used and can be used for profound and serious research. And for the things to think about what the Russians are going to do with it, I think that or what they're going to say about it is not the right moment. I think when the Russians are shooting at Ukrainians, it doesn't really matter what they say.
Now, you raised an interesting point about the archives, because that's one issue of this that hasn't been discussed a lot. Everybody's focusing on the banning of the Soviet and Nazi symbols and things like that. But the opening of the archives is got to be something that I think we all can agree is a pretty damn good thing. I personally remember when Estonia opened its Soviet era security service archives in the 90s. And I was in Tallinn so damn fast because I wanted to look at those archives and wrote a series of articles based on them. And it was a treasure trove. And Estonia is a tiny little country where a lot of awful things happened, granted. But Ukraine is another matter entirely. And opening the Soviet era security service archives in Ukraine is a huge gift to scholars and to scholarly research. I think we can all agree on that for sure. Taras, what are your thoughts on this? We have kind of two different diametrically opposing points of view here with Lukan and Natalia. What are your thoughts?
I would always take in these things a centrist position between both of our guests, and I'll tell you why, because I think the open letter is a bit deceitful in the sense that it focuses not on all four laws, it focuses on only a part of them. What the open letter should have done in the beginning of it is discuss the positive sides of what was adopted. So I can give you four examples. Banning Soviet symbols, I don't have a problem with that. You can't go around Germany with Nazi symbols. Two, equating Nazism and Sovietism. Again, this is nothing unusual. The OSCE European Parliament did this back in 2008. Opening archives, we've mentioned. Elimination of street names, again, I don't think that's necessarily a problem. Where, of course, it becomes a bit contentious, but maybe not completely, is in the state's role in implementing denazification or decommunization. Lukan says the state shouldn't have any role, all these authors shouldn't. Well, if that's the case, what did the German state do after World War II? If a state doesn't have any role, then we have the Japanese scenario where they just forget about World War II crimes. So I think there is a role for the state to remove the legacy of totalitarianism. But how one goes about it is, of course, the key question.
Yeah, no, and Taras, you raise a good point here. I mean, Europe has a lot of, not to play whataboutism, it's something I always criticize the Russian authorities for doing, but I'm going to do it now. Europe has very similar laws. You can't display Nazi symbols, not just in Germany, but in much of Europe. And it's weird for me as an American, because our First Amendment protections of free speech are pretty much absolute. But I also understand that America is the exception here, and America has the good fortune to live next door to Canada and not next door to Russia or Nazi Germany. So we've never had to deal with something like this in America, so we have the luxury of having our free speech laws being pretty damn close to absolute. So we have laws like this in Europe. They exist in Germany. They exist in much of Europe. And so what Ukraine's doing here isn't terribly radical from if you look at it in the context of mainstream Europe. But what about that, Luke? I mean, we seem to be coming at this from a perspective of North Americans, where we never had to deal with things like this.
Well, fair enough, but on the other hand, there are a lot of things that the West has done that I think Ukraine shouldn't repeat. I'm not so sure these are necessarily a good idea in Germany, but that's not the point. I think the point is that right now you have Ukraine. I mean, Natalia talks about what Ukrainians think, but that's in fact contested. You know, Ukrainians aren't unified. I wish they were, but they're not. And to not recognize that and to make it illegal to have these points of view, I think is really misguided.
I don't think it's making it illegal to have these points of view. It's illegal.
So what's
the, nothing's going to happen about that. I mean, nobody's going to go to jail about that. Come on,
that's all the worst.
Natalia?
Well, I think it's the letter was a bit misguided when it used the term that there is a criminal responsibility to deny the criminal character of the communist and totalitarian regime and things like that. There is no criminal responsibility, and some critics of these laws from Ukraine say that it's not radical enough, but it's not clear enough. And I think this is the criticism which comes from both sides in this case, because in Ukraine, the people who are saying that there are people who are saying that it's not clear what is the responsibility in this case, because if you want to defend your point of view, if you want to defend it in court, the courts are not going to take this case because the law is not clear enough about what's going to happen. But coming back to this letter from the point of view of Ukrainian, I think what is another thing which was very disturbing and very unfortunate in the wording of the letter is that the wholesale condemnation of the entire Soviet period, as far as one of the occupation is of Ukraine, will have unjust and incongruous consequences. And then the authors say that one cannot deny that there was the development of the Ukrainian culture and the language in the 20s. And of course, as historians, you should both know that all the people who were big proponents and who were the developers of the Ukrainian culture and language at that time, the most important Ukrainian writers and scholars were killed by the Soviet regime just a few years later. So I don't think that it is really fair to pick the good times in the Soviet regime and say that at this time Ukrainians were repressed less than in the other times. That would, for me, that sounds like you want to subtract the time that prisoners are spending in the prison and feeling good during their lunchtime or during their sleep or something like that. So I think it's the regime has not changed, and saying that it was less harsh at some periods doesn't change the whole criminal character of the regime altogether.
Yeah, no, Natalia, I think this is an interesting point, because in the inevitable comparisons with Germany we're going to have to keep coming back to, and there's no getting around it. But it was pretty, it's easier for the Germans to break off that Nazi period, which is a shorter period. We're talking about a long period in Ukraine here. That was the Soviet period. It was entire lifetime. It's a whole generation.
Three generations.
So, with the Nazi period, we're talking about a small period, which was largely covered by World War II and the immediate period before it. And this I could see why this was put into the piece, because again, three generations lived and died in this period. Are we going to throw all that away? And it leads to this ambiguity. Well, it wasn't all that bad because it wasn't so concentrated. But within that period, you had the Holodomor. You had millions of people being starved to death.
Exactly.
So it's tricky, and I'm not sure where I would come down on that. But Taras or Lukan, do you want to address that?
You know, this is not about, you know, I'm as anti-communist as they come. You know, I've studied this period.
I think we all are.
I mean, you know, and no one says that this is, you know, not, you know, this regime wasn't criminal. But the point is that the state should not be involved in legislating that point of view. That's fundamentally unpluralist. And, you know, maybe, and I think that's the important thing, is that we shouldn't be legislating. As a result, instead of using valuable RFERL time to talk about the crimes of Putin, we're talking about this stuff.
We spend plenty of valuable RFERL time talking about the crimes of Putin. Don't you worry about that.
There's, better, it's aid and comfort to Putin.
I think, Brian, it's as you kind of already pointed out, and some of my our colleagues have pointed out in Ukraine, some of the wording is done very badly. So to me, it strikes as though it's like the flip opposite of what's happening in Russia. So in Russia, if we have a rehabilitation of the Soviet period and the ignoring of the crimes and saying that the Soviet Union was good because it produced a superpower and industrialization, socio-economic development, here we're saying everything's bad. So everything's good in the Soviet Union, in Russia, everything's bad in Ukraine. Of course, the truth is somewhere in the middle. It wasn't all bad and all good. I think, though, where I would argue what's missing here is a more inclusive approach to history. And I don't think I'd agree with Lucan to say the state has no responsibility in the field of history. I mean, for Christ's sake, the state produces textbooks for schools. And that's true in most societies. And textbooks have to prepare information. I've been collecting history school textbooks in Ukraine since the 90s. And the best ones were always in the Kuchma era. Because why? Because he was a moderate East Ukrainian. He wasn't anti-Russian, but he was also critical of Russian policies to Ukraine. And his view was that everything that happened in Ukraine is Ukrainian history. So if you're talking about fighters for Ukraine, that includes nationalists, includes Soviet Ukrainians in World War II fighting the Nazis. It includes Ukrainians in the Polish, Canadian, and American forces. Those are included in textbooks. And it includes, of course, dissidents. You can have that more inclusive approach. The Western historian does that is Paul Robert Mogocci in Toronto. And over his history of Ukraine is a territorial history. So it includes histories of Tatars, Poles, Russians, Jews, as well as Ukrainians. But this is more, I would say, ideologized version of looking at history. Whereas the state should have the role of putting forward the information, and then it's up to the individual to decide whether they're pro-Soviet, pro-nationalist, or whatever. But it's not the job of the state to say this is good or this is bad. So I would agree to some degree with Lucan. And it's also, it's not obviously true to say that the entire period from 1917 to 1991 was a period of struggle for independence. Most people in Soviet Ukraine did not join dissident movements.
No, they were a minority. One of the reasons this is particular...
One thing, the Soviet Ukrainian Communist Party was the largest in the Soviet Union until 1990, when Russia created its own.
The only problem is that it has never been a Ukrainian Communist Party. It was the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in Ukraine. And the first opportunity the Communists had, they betrayed Ukrainians, and we now witness this at this present war. I think we are struggling here to make a comparison with the Nazi regime and the Soviet regime. Here, because the laws treat both equally, I think we don't treat both equally here. Not only because the Nazi regime was more concentrated and was more deadly in a shorter period of time, but also because I think it is studied better in the West, and it's arguably that there are much more literature about the Nazi crimes than it is about the Stalinist crimes, and it's also because it lost the war, and not because that's the other reason.
This is one of the key things. The Soviet Union never formally they lost the Cold War indisputably, but it was not they were not defeated in the way that the Nazis were, where they had to take a good close look at themselves.
Exactly, because if we look at the Ukrainian soldiers in the Soviet army, in the Red Army and the Soviet army, the last periods of the Second World War, they were fighting for their country, but they could not defend their people from their authorities. And in that sense, the nationalist movements, the UPA, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, was the only force fighting for Ukrainians as it is. So it's I think it's even difficult to compare in those terms.
No, I mean this is one of the reasons why this is particularly thorny in Ukraine. And I'm reminded of a conversation I had with a Latvian historian back in the 90s when I was looking at this very issue in Latvia. And she said to me, Latvia had two enemies and no place to turn. And this is also true for Ukraine. You can argue Ukraine, like Latvia, is part of what Professor Timothy Snyder at Yale University calls the bloodlands, the Europe that was stuck between Hitler and Stalin. And where do you turn in that situation? And therefore, if the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you're going to turn to one evil side or the other, depending upon who you are. I once had a conversation with a Latvian Holocaust survivor and raised this issue with him. And I asked him, did he blame the Latvians who sided with the Nazis? And he looked at me and said, do I look like a Stalinist to you? And I said, excuse me? I said, I don't understand how that relates to the question. He goes, well, I fought in Stalin's army. Did I fight in it because I was a Stalinist? No, I fought in it because Stalin was fighting Hitler. And to me, as a Jew, Hitler was the most evil thing in the world. Well, to these Latvians, the Soviet regime was the most evil thing in the world, and therefore they were going to side with the enemy. None of us had any place to go. So if you're going to condemn them as Nazis, you have to condemn me as a Stalinist. And this is why this issue is really, really thorny in Ukraine.
Take the example of the Crimean Tatars. The Crimean Tatars who were in the Soviet army, they were fighting for their motherland in the Soviet army at the same time as the Soviet army was fighting with their families and deporting their families mm-hmm. from the Crimea. So where do they have to belong? How do they have to look at the Soviet regime for which they fought?
No, it's again, this is Ukraine is one of these countries where World War II is never going away because they were caught between these two regimes. Taras, you want to say something?
I just wanted to say that what was missed in the open letter as well is the good intentions. Yes, I think there's a lot of things badly written, but good intentions were that you have a choice in this part of the world. The choice is between celebrating the end of World War II on May 9th as the Great Patriotic War and forgetting about the Nazi-Soviet collaboration and celebrating Stalin as the great leader. Or you have the new Ukrainian approach, which is moved to the European, celebrating the end of World War II on May 8th and celebrating it as Second World War, not as the Great Patriotic War. And the reason both countries are different is that in one country they rehabilitate Stalin, and in this country they've been debunking Stalin since the late 1980s. And so you have a different path. And that is a positive. It's not a negative thing. But this kind of thing should have been in that open letter as well to make it more balanced. But it was, I think, too biased, too subjective.
That's a good point, Taras. And I actually, one of the things I wanted to, and since we have Lukan here as one of the signatories, I wanted to get people who signed the letter to weigh in on this. Do you have a problem with these laws in principle or just as drafted?
I have a problem in principle with the idea of legislating interpretations of history. Brian, you stated very eloquently, these are thorny historical issues, which suggests that it's probably quite dangerous to legislate one interpretation of these points of view.
But as Taras pointed out, any country that has public education, and Ukraine is a country with public education, the last time I checked, the state's going to be involved in writing textbooks for schools. They are in the United States.
Absolutely. And I never said that the state shouldn't be involved at all about this. I'm saying that the state should be involved in promoting a plurality of views that reflects Ukraine as it really is.
So, for example, in World War II, in that sense, you know, when I go back to the inclusive approach, a school textbook, like I remember in the Kuchma era, was more that case. Because since Kuchma, you had Yushchenko more towards the nationalist position and Yanukovych towards the Soviet position, whereas Kuchma was kind of in the middle. And his view in school textbooks in World War II would be there was a Soviet soldiers fighting the Nazis, Soviet Ukrainian soldiers, and then there was also the nationalists, and they even had Ukrainian troops in the Polish, American, and Canadian army. So in that sense, you're providing information about everything that's taking place. You know, some teachers are going to maybe side with one position or the other, and then it's really up to pupils, I guess, to have a position. You know, they decide on the basis of what they hear from teachers whether they like this position or that position.
That is the essence of liberalism.
Natalia, you wanted to jump in here.
I would like to come back to Lucan's point at the very beginning, that he said that the these laws are very divisive. And I think what is really divisive in the Ukrainian society now is not the laws themselves, but the interpretation of them. And let me give you an example of yesterday's talk show, where the question... They presented these laws, and they were talking about them, and they presented the outcome of a poll where the question was put like this: whether you support the marking of the 70th anniversary of the great victory against the Nazi on the 9th of May, or do you support the celebration on the, or the some kind of marking of the 8th of May? And I think in this way, predictably, 70-something percent in Kiev, 90-something percent in Donbass said, of course, we do want to mark the 70th anniversary of the great victory against the Nazis. We don't know what the 8th of May is. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very manipulative way how things are being presented for the Ukrainian public. And I think there is nothing wrong about the marking of the 70th anniversary of the great victory against the Nazis, because everyone else does that, and 80% of the world fought in this war, and the Nazis were defeated, and I think that's the right thing to do. But presenting things like that to the Ukrainian public is a very unfortunate
thing.
This
was done on Ukrainian television?
And that was done on the Ukrainian television.
Mm. But on this, you see, the state does have a role to play. If we decide, and I think that is correct, that Stalin was an evil tyrant, like Adolf Hitler, then... we should be promoting the European 8th of May and inclusive World War II rather than Great Patriotic War. And I think, maybe Lucan disagrees, but the state has a role in moving public opinion away from 9th of May to 8th of May. But this, of course, takes time. You don't do this overnight. And you do this by persuasion. And you explain that, you know, Stalin was the biggest Nazi collaborator, not a war, no war. He collaborated for 3 years.
Yikes.
And that's ignored by the Russian regime. So I think it's a question of, you know, the state does have a role. How it does that role, how it presents it, of course, is the tricky questions. And sometimes the Ukrainian legislators can get it wrong.
If I may, that's precisely the issue. It's about persuasion. It's not about legislating one point of view over the other. And the point is that it's precisely because Ukraine right now faces an existential threat. This is the time when we focus on what unites Ukraine, which is a lot. This is not the time to focus on things that profoundly divide the Ukrainian public. This seems deeply irresponsible.
Yeah, no, this is, I mean, and Lucan, you're basically echoing what Anton Chekhovsov, who's been a guest on this podcast in the past, and I was hoping to get him on today as well, but he's a very busy man, as you can all imagine. But he wrote me in an email that I wanted to read part of it on air. He said essentially it is the future rather than history that can be the basis for the development of the Ukrainian nation. Natalia, how would you respond to that?
I agree entirely that it is the future that Ukrainians are going to unite behind. And on the other hand, you have to make clear what happened in the past. And without this, when they say that the whole Europe went through the process of reconciliation and mutual forgiveness, there should be a place for that forgiveness. First, there should be some kind of redemption and repentance. When you don't see that from the other side, there is no forgiveness in this case. So you cannot close the door behind your past, because it comes back, and it comes back in a very real forms now, in the forms of the Soviet propaganda, of the images of the Soviet propaganda being reused now by the Russian propaganda.
Yeah, and that's a very good segue to the second half, because I wanted to look at that, contrasting Ukraine with Russia on this issue in the second half. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and take a look at how Ukraine's efforts at decommunization are also part of a larger trend in Ukraine differentiating itself from its much larger northern neighbor. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio is Natalia Chudakova, senior editor of RFERL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. Joining us on the Skype line from Kyiv is Taras Kuzio, a senior research associate at the Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. Also joining us from Kyiv, also via Skype, is Lucan Wei of the Center for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Toronto. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Any reform comes with a cost, but I think this cost will be justified because this is precisely how a country begins to change. Again, we are looking at the experience of the countries of Eastern Europe, which have passed through decommunization. See how far ahead they have moved as normal democratic states. On the other hand, we can look at countries like Russia or Belarus, where there has been no decommunization. On the contrary, there we see the rehabilitation of the Soviet past. And these countries are moving increasingly toward authoritarianism.
And that was Volodymyr Vitarhovich, the director of the Ukraine's Institute of National Memory, speaking to RFERL's Russian service about Ukraine's anti-communist laws, making the point there that the countries that went through decommunization, the countries of Central and Eastern, the former socialist countries of Central and Eastern Europe, in addition to the Baltic states and of the former Soviet countries, they've become stable, democratic, liberal regimes. Those that haven't, Belarus, Russia, and other parts of the Soviet Union, have remained authoritarian. So, and he's like, I got to say, he's got a point there. As I've noted in the past, in many ways, post-Soviet Ukraine and post-Soviet Russia were separated at birth. And I've go through the litany of things. I've said it all before. I'll say it again. When Ukraine's first post-Soviet president, Leonid Kravchuk, faced a political crisis with his parliament, he held an early election, lost, and stepped aside. When Russia's first post-Soviet president, Boris Yeltsin, had a political crisis with his parliament, he shelled it into submission. Ukraine's elections have been competitive affairs in which incumbents often lose. Russia's elections are stage-managed affairs in which the incumbent always wins. Ukraine's civil society is vibrant and growing stronger. Russia's has been crushed or co-opted. Despite its problems, and they are many, Ukraine in many ways represents the road not taken by Russia, but it hasn't taken the road all the way. Natalia, despite the problems with the anti-communist laws, do they represent a culmination of this process, or as Lucan suggests, are they a threat to this process?
Well, first thing is really supporting Volodymyr Vitrovich's point of view, I think, and this is a quote of the Ukrainian professor of history who says that there is nothing costs as much as the chaos in one's heads. And I think Ukraine is trying to clear up a bit of that chaos in the heads of the people, but I wouldn't overestimate the power of the Ukrainian state, and that is something that the message I would like to convey.
Nobody ever got rich overestimating the power of the Ukrainian state.
Convey to the critics who are saying that Ukrainian state is taking the too big a role in. The process of legitimizing what people should think. I don't really think that the Ukrainian state at any stage of its development will develop such an ability. But I think it is really important to get the foundations right. And if these foundations, and I think they are getting themselves right in the process of the development of the Ukrainian state and the even more so of the Ukrainian society, because I think that the Ukrainian society shapes the Ukrainian state, not the other way around.
Increasingly so now, too.
to a degree that we hadn't seen in the past.
Exactly. And it is also a huge difference between the Ukrainian state and the Ukrainian society and the Russian state or the neighboring former Soviet countries, which have not gone through the process of decommunization and de-totalitarization.
I mean, Lukan, doesn't Natalia have a point here, though? I mean, when you look, and if you, the quote we played at the beginning of the segment, I mean, the countries that have gone through this process, the countries that were in Professor Snyder's bloodlands, you know, this Europe between Hitler and Stalin, those that have gone through this process have become prosperous, liberal, stable democracies, and those that have not have remained authoritarian. Isn't it right for Ukraine to get on the correct side of that divide? And aren't these laws, albeit imperfect, a step in that direction? I mean, would you agree with that, or would you not?
Well, you know, I'm a political scientist, and one of the things we learned in first year of graduate school is that correlation does not equal causation. That there's very little evidence that decommunization by itself is responsible for...
Not by itself, but it contributes to.
Well, quite unclear. I mean, I think studies of restoration in Czech Republic have shown that, you know, it can have quite the opposite effect. And, you know, I think that that's a mistake. And the point is we have to also take local context into account. I mean, this is still a very divided country. And I think it's a real mistake to sort of take what is quite literally a Soviet approach to these problems. I mean, this is, you know, in an effort to get beyond the Soviet Union, we're basically relying on the tools of Stalin, not to put it, you know.
Well, I wouldn't put it quite that far. We're not talking about shooting people.
Okay. Second point. But I think, you know, I think Natalia's right that, you know, these laws are unlikely to be implemented in actuality. But these primarily have a symbolic value, right? And so in that sense, I think I'm a little less nervous than some others, because I assume that laws will be followed as much as any other law in Ukraine, which is not very much. But I think they have important symbolic value, and the symbolism is awful, which is to politicize history. And I mean, that's exactly what Putin is trying to do. It's sort of feeding right exactly into what it's like. I don't see what we're gaining from this.
Taras, is this a politicization of history, or is this an attempt to come to terms to
history? I think this is a bit of an exaggeration here. Yes, it's true to some extent, but it's not completely the case. If we're looking at the different strands of, shall we say, 20th century history, the only contentious period is, of course, the Ukrainian nationalists in World War II.
Yeah.
Not the Holodomor, that now a majority, you're talking two-thirds to three-quarters of Ukrainians, believe the Holodomor was genocide. That's an incredible high figure in most regions of Ukraine outside Donbass, Crimea. Nobody has a problem with Ukraine dissidents. Nobody has a problem with 1917 Ukrainian People's Republic armed forces either. So it's really only one period of time. This is a contentious issue, which is why an approach that includes everybody who fought for Ukraine in World War II as part of Ukraine history, in the same way as you can't ignore Ukrainian nationalists in World War II, you can't ignore the millions of Ukrainians who were in the Soviet army. At the same time as condemning, of course, the criminal nature of NKVD. So, I mean, I think World War II is the only divisive issue. And that, you know, that is the case with Oum Upa. But the I think it's a question of how they approached this. We met somebody this morning, Lucan and myself, from the presidential administration, a political consultant advisor, and he told us that Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, will be improving the laws, but he will be unable to turn them down and not sign them into action because that would just ruin the coalition in parliament. Mm-hmm. You have a parliamentary system. These are laws tended to have come from the popular front of Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, and he therefore can't say no to not signing them, but he will be improving them. I think if we take the four laws all together, I think the contentious part is less... is the minority of the four. I think the majority of what is there is good and takes Ukraine in the right direction of where it should be going.
And you, by that you mean everything except the part dealing with the nationalists during World War II?
It's the way that you're legislating what is good and bad. I mean, that's you're on tricky ground there.
Mm-hmm.
Same time, unlike Luke, and I have a more stronger view, that in Europe, where you've had these terrible regimes, there is a role for the state. How can there not be a role for the state? Now, how that role happens, what it does, is, of course, very, very difficult. But you can get advice from organizations like the Council of Europe and elsewhere that will I think, move you in the right direction. But certainly, I think, destroying the legacies of Stalinism and Nazism is a good step. I mean, it certainly puts you more in line with Europe as opposed to Russia here.
How would you improve these laws, Natalia? What would you...
Well, I think some of the amendments have already been adopted, and these things about the unclarity, about the sense of the responsibility, and also about the symbols of the Soviet regime on the medals and things like that, so that people who wear the Soviet medals wouldn't become liable for a crime or whatever because they're wearing them. So I think that was made clear, and there probably will be some other things that people will want to improve, and rightly so. I think these laws should be made as clear as they can, but I think in the totality of them, I think they are a huge leap in the right direction, in the sense that it makes clear what Ukraine as a state, Ukraine as a nation, wants to make with its past and with its future. I think even though we are discussing the past all the time, I think they are aimed at the future. And this is not only what the critics should be pointing out, but mostly the people who were behind these laws. And I think Volodymyr Vyatrovich also points it out, that without putting this behind us, we cannot move forward.
Yeah. No, and on that bit of like the state legislating history, again, like I said before, for any state that has public education, the state, it's not legislating history, but it has a role in the interpretation of history because it commissions textbooks to be used in schools. But it's my feeling and my understanding of these laws is they do not restrict scholars in their research.
Not at all. And they said it clearly.
And so if you believe, as I do, that Ukraine sooner or later is going to turn into a liberal Western society, Ukrainian historians are very capable, and they're going to work this out and together with their Western colleagues. And this is, you're going to get an emerging historical consensus on what happened during the Second World War, the good, the bad, and the ugly, but hopefully the true. No?
Well, especially now that they got the access to the documents.
Yeah. And to me, I mean, if there's one that is the unsung hero of these laws. And I bet the Russians are freaking out about that more than anything else, because if these archives don't just pertain to what happened on the territory of Ukraine. There's a lot of material in there that incriminate Russia as well. So this is going to be it's going to be a treasure trove for scholars.
Exactly, and
a
I think
treasure trove.
What the Polish scholars noticed immediately, and the first news after the adoption of those laws was that the Polish archives and the Ukrainian archives are going to exchange the documents. So these are the things that everyone expected, that the Poles are going to be offended, because these laws were adopted the same day the Polish president was talking to the Ukrainian parliament, and the Poles had the biggest problem was the Ukrainian insurgent army. And what we hear is that the Polish president says that it is the political decision of the Ukrainian state and of Ukrainian politicians, and they will have to take the responsibility, and we have nothing to do with the Ukrainian heroes, or who are the people that Ukrainians consider their heroes. And the second thing was that the Polish scientists are going to historians are going to study in the Ukrainian archives. And I think this is the best answer to all the critics about the legislation, the point of view. They're not going to be legislated. So whatever is there will be taken out. It will be published, will be discussed, will be studied. Yesterday, there was a big discussion here in Prague at the Institute for Totalitarian Regimes. And they were talking exactly about these things, about the UPA, about the Ukrainian insurgent army. army in the Czech archives. If you talk to the average Czech here, they will say that they were bandits, that they were rapists and things like that. But none of that is supported by the data from the archives. And they were talking about this for 3 hours, showing this and that document, which supports exactly this idea that once you open the archives, you can have a discussion, you can have serious work, not the propaganda work. Mm-hmm.
Lukan or Taras, anything to add to that?
I just don't want to say if this law were simply about opening the archives, we obviously wouldn't be having this discussion, because I think all of us would be in favor of that. But it's obviously not just that, and that is not what's controversial. And I would be happy if they stripped up everything in the law except for that. But I'm happy to hear that yesterday there were passed amendments that explicitly say that scholars can do research, that explicitly allow people to buy and sell pioneer pins and whatnot on the street. But frankly, the issue is that, just as I said before, the law is never really going to be implemented. So I'm not really scared about freedom of speech being abrogated.
Well, it's going to be implemented. I mean, the archives are going to be opened. Names are going to be changed. That's going to happen.
But the most offensive parts are probably not going to be implemented.
But Brian, I think going back to the open letter, where the open letter was biased was that it talked about the massacre of Poles in Volyn in World War II by the UPAO or UN, which is a fact. But at the same time, a credible, objective historian like Paul Robert Mogoci talks about 60,000 Poles who died and 20,000 Ukrainians who died at the hands of extremist Poles. That wasn't mentioned in the open letter. So let's put it all out there. If we're just putting, this is actually a selective use of history as well, the open letter. It's not just these laws. But I think I go back to the question of comparing this actually to 2006, because in 2006, Ukraine adopted a law on the Holodomor, which was not supported in parliament by the Party of Regions and the communists. Mm-hmm. The law also said it was criminal to deny that the Holodomor happened. Now, I don't recall anybody actually going to jail for denying it, because the Party of Regions denied it and the communists. But at the same time, how is this different from the criminal nature of denying the Holocaust in many European countries? Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. So although this is politicization, at the same time we have it in Europe, and I think I would agree with the criminal nature of denying the Holocaust. So why can't we have the same with the Holodomor? So, it's tricky ground, and you have to go through it very carefully. I think where the criticism would be of the supporters of the laws is that they were rushed through it and they weren't written very well.
I think let's face it, any piece of legislation can always be improved upon, and hopefully this legislation will be improved upon. We're getting up against the clock now. Anybody have any last thoughts before we wrap it up for this week?
Just to reiterate that the point of these laws is the most offensive parts are purely symbolic, but they're symbolic in the worst sense and polarizing an already very polarized situation in Ukraine.
At the same time, I don't think that with or without these laws, Russian TV, the Russian president, is still going to continue to call Ukrainians fascists.
Exactly.
This is going to have no impact. The way that the Russians seem to think today, they're either good little Russians and the remainder are fascists.
What I'm more concerned about is how it goes over in Ukraine. And I haven't seen any polling data about public support for these laws. I haven't come across anything. And Natalia, if you haven't, it means it doesn't exist.
Not yet. Probably not.
All right. Last word to you, Natalia, before we wrap it up.
I would really see it as a symbolic act, but I wouldn't say that it is a bad symbolism. And I think we should see it as in the light of Ukrainian independence and fight for independence now. And I really think it's a kind of declaration of independence which did not happen 23 years ago when every other country in Europe close its door on the totalitarian past, and Ukraine only does it now, and only because it fights Russia in the east.
So we are culminating the hope of 1991, as to bring it back full circle to where I began, would be your take on
right.
this. Yeah? On that note, we'll wrap it up. That's unfortunately all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio here in Prague is Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFRL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. And joining us on the Skype line from Kyiv has been Taras Kuzio, a research associate at the Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. And also joining us from Kyiv, also via Skype, has been Lukan Wei of the Center for European, Russian and Eurasian Studies at the University of Toronto. Thank you all for an enlightening discussion. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.